So we're going to go ahead and get started. For those of you that I haven't met yet, my name is Chime Chen, and I served on as part of the gathering planning committee this year. Dan Kim is a good friend of mine for the last 18 years, and he's somebody studied English and is currently an English high school teacher, and somebody who has taught me to pay attention to words. I think one of the things that struck me about the description that he wrote for this workshop was how poetry may help us to pay attention or attend to creation as well as to people around us. And I think that fits well with what we've been hearing both from Jesse preaching, listening to creation, as well as the lectio this morning. So, welcome.
Thanks. So, appreciate you being here, and, I originally titled this, In the Beginning, ... Creation and the World, but, or the Word, but I was convicted by Norman's Henry and say, talking about creation, not just at the beginning, but continuing on throughout history. And so, In the Beginning, Middle, and End, Creation and the Word, incorporative and participatory ways to align with the reign of God. So putting everything in context to what is God doing in our world and how is it good. And what's really important is that it would be incorporative and participatory. So after lunch, it's always very difficult to kind of maintain one's, you know, as alert and wakefulness. And so we're going to work together, and I hope that that keeps us awake and seeing. So, we have a do now. I'm a teacher, so we always do nows. I don't know if you know what a do now is. It's the first thing that the students do when they come in. They have an activity just to get them kind of warmed up. It's like a warm-up. So we're going to do a little warm-up. And our warm-up involves the object that you see before you. And you're going to write a poem based on this particular object. Okay? Now, I know immediately when I say the term poem, some people have this visceral like, I cannot write a poem. Why are you asking me to write a poem? It has to be flowery. It has to be, you know, metered. It has to rhyme. Let me try to set some context for our activity. So on your handout, but it's also up here, you can look here, is a poem by Mary Oliver, and it's called Praying. And so I want this to shape how we go about doing this activity together. Erin, would you mind reading the poem for us?
It doesn't have to be the blue iris. It could be the weeds in a vacant lot or a few small stones. Just pay attention, then patch a few words together and don't try to make them elaborate. This isn't a contest, but the doorway into thanks and the silence in which another voice can speak.
There are so many barriers for us to enter into kind of the, whether it's thinking about the environment seriously or thinking about poetry seriously, there's so many barriers that, that prevent us from entering in. And so I just want to say and ask you to patch some words together. Put some words together, and you're just paying attention. I picked up these things on my way from and to different plenary sessions. And I took that from my daughter. My daughter, Ella, is 4 years old, and as the children shall lead us, she takes her time whenever she goes anywhere, and she has to pick up every single rock that she sees on the way. Of course, that makes it very difficult to get anywhere and frustrating for her dad. And then she collects these rocks in our car in the side little panel, and she puts those rocks there. And so taking kind of something from her here, that I've collected some stuff, and a lot of times poets or teachers might say, just write what's on your mind. And I think that's too overwhelming, because there's a lot in our mind. And somehow, it is, some of us more than others, but it's helpful sometimes to have actually some focus or some limitation in order to free our imagination. And so that's you know, we're going to be forced to just look at this particular object together. Or not together, but for yourself. And then patch some words together. So I'm going to give you about 5 minutes, not a lot of time, to look at your object, experience your object, and patch some words together. Okay? So, go for it. And it's not a contest, okay, but a doorway into things. How can you make it a doorway into fantasy? Yeah, no, you look like you're in the midst of the last idea. I'll let you finish. Jimmy, what do you think? Can you take a break from your writing?
Yeah.
Okay. Would you mind reading the poem for me again?
Sure.
Thanks.
Pray by Mary Oliver. It doesn't have to be the blue iris. It could be weeds in a vacant lot or a few small stones. Just pay attention, then patch. A few words together and don't try to make them elaborate. This isn't a contest, but the doorway into thanks. And a silence in which another voice may speak.
So, what did you hear, and what words did you patch together? Just some examples. Again, it's not a contest, but just ways that we can hear from each other and hear from certain objects. So, any volunteers? Okay. You can show your object first, and then...
Yeah.
Okay.
Seems to be a piece of coal. Maybe someone can correct me, but that's what it looks like to me. And my poem kind of speaks a little bit to my ignorance about it. It took millions of years, perhaps, maybe billions, or maybe just thousands. A more informed geologist could tell me precisely when and how, by what machinations, you came into this type of existence. Your rough edges, the way they splinter and flake in my hand, speak a testimony about your journey through time and space. From some earthy cave to some urban sidewalk to someone's pocket to this classroom table, the least I could do is listen.
We have the journey of this piece of coal, this rock, from way back when to now, and just the mystery of what that journey was like, and taking you back to where it came from, the origin of that particular piece. Very nice. Thank you. Others. I know you're dying to share.
I have a stick. My grandpa was a sod man. He spent his years in the sun, growing the business for his family, and the clothes on his back, depending literally on the grass of the field. Sun-browned, tough skin, covered an interior full of life, but sometimes covered his winters.
So, instead of the object, kind of, what is the odd, where did it come from? This evoked a memory of your father and your relationship with him, his working at his job, and also the splinters that he experienced while he was working. Okay, very good. How about you? Female voice?
Okay, I have this.
All right.
Pointed green leaves along a stem, aimed in different directions, some up, some down, some flattened, yet all connected to and linked by the same stem, and so belong together, each a part of the other's welfare and identity. Fragile green branch, can we learn from you how much we all belong together?
Very nice. So, taking the physical attributes of the object and then seeing what perhaps the connections are between the leaves and the stem, and taking it from a physical standpoint. Great. What did you feel like you experienced while you were doing it? This particular exercise and participating in poetry. What was valuable? What was helpful in just spending some time in front of an object, writing a couple of words down? What did you experience while you did that?
I experienced two opposing forms of anxiety. The first was, oh my gosh, what do I say?
Uh-huh.
And then a minute later, I had this great idea, and then my anxiety became, oh my gosh, how do I write this fast enough? Within the time given.
There is this kind of anxiety that we have. I mean, we can tie it to just what we've been hearing this week, just like there's, what do I do? There's so much to be done. And then you have some imagination of maybe something to do, but is there enough time to do it? There's something reflective about about what you just said, so appreciate that. Other things that you experience besides anxiety, maybe? Yeah.
Maybe there was sort of a, what should I say and what should I not say? How does it fit together? And I had a lot of different ideas, but it maybe wouldn't all fit together.
Uh-huh.
And so, what did you do, what did you say? Mm-hmm. Sort of, well, anxiety is the word, but sort of uncertainty about this and feeling like, oh, I don't write poems, what am I doing?
So just the tension of what needs to be said, what shouldn't be said, what can be held back, what shouldn't be said at all. Yeah, those are tensions that we definitely see. Others?
Yeah. I felt kind of like a very narrowing sense of focus, you know? Because like you said, if you just said write a poem, just all over the map, and even given enough focus to this, that narrows it,
but it still
is pretty wide open. And
yeah.
So I just started writing, and then it's almost like, you know, after just forcing yourself to write a couple lines, you sort of find these tracks, and it just kept getting, for me, that was my experience, more and more focused and just sort of falling into a zone, I guess you could say, of where the writing is taking you,
uh-huh.
And into that world, into that perspective, and away from all the things that you were noticing at the time,
uh-huh.
and kind of channeling you into the direction of the writing, if that makes sense.
Yeah. So there's a focusing that happens when we stop and are forced to focus on this one object. It actually allows us to enter into that particular object. At the same time, I think we feel the gravity of the situation in some ways, and being able to articulate these things. And I think that's the feeling that I want us to have, because I mean, your name is,
Adam.
Adam's point of like, I don't know how to write poetry. Why am I here? How do I put words to this? That's the challenge I have always as a high school English teacher, is how to draw people into poetry and this passion that I have. But I don't tell my students that I'm teaching poetry, because it's kind of like what Norman Wordsworth said about nature, and using that word. Poetry immediately kind of boom, you know, just like there's this wall that's created. And my job as a teacher is to not create walls. I hope that when we're listening to the plenary speakers, that it's not creating boom walls of like, I can't enter, this is too big for me, how do I enter in? And hopefully we don't get despairing. And so the way I teach poetry is that I say that it's a way of seeing. That everything that I do, it kind of comes back to some of you may be familiar with Plato's allegory of the cave, where you got some princes looking at the back of the wall, and they are just seeing shadows, and in the back is light. And my job as a teacher is to kind of just, not to help them, give them something new, but just to turn them to see clearly and see something new. And so I believe that poems, and this is from a book by Marilyn McIntyre, it's called Caring for Words in a Culture of Lies. Poems demand that we slow down, notice patterns, reckon with ambiguities, consider subtle distinctions between one term or image and its alternative, and recognize the relationship between techniques and purposes. And so it does require that focus, that slowing down, that is counter to the way that we want to be active and make change and do stuff and get going. It really requires to slow down and help us see. And maybe we don't know what road we're going to go take. We don't know what word we're going to use, but we start moving down that road and see what happens. Fred Bunsen, in a work that he wrote with Norman Wordsworth, says, at its best, poetry is not flowery language or wordplay. It is a way of seeing, which is to say a way of knowing. And so I hope that's the way that we can not have barriers put up for us. And I hope as we participate in the workshop that we'll enter in together. Just some background on me. I teach in San Francisco at an urban school. And I was asked to be part of this pathway called the Green Academy. The Green Academy is a small cohort of students interested in environmental issues. When my wife heard that I was invited to be a teacher in the Screen Academy, she laughed. They chose you? Why did they chose you? Because she knows who I am. I grew up in Southern California in Los Angeles in a nice suburb that whenever I came to a fruit that came off a tree, I was suspicious. This fruit is dirty. It's coming from nature. And I'm confession right now. And so that's where I come from. And anything that was not packaged, I was suspicious of. So to the fact that they would ask me to even be part of this Green Academy, I was like, okay. And that's as a way to say that I've been learning. And there's a way that I'm entering in to the conversation. Because I think we can hear particular issues and we can say, no, I can't enter into that. That's too much. Or that's, you know. But we just enter in. Or this poem, man, I don't know if I can enter in. But we go each step of the way and then we enter in. And so that's what I hope that we're able, that posture that of just being willing to open our hands and move forward, I think is a part of poetry. Now, that being said, my students are even more phobic of nature because they grew up in the city, and they are phobic of poetry. So so the question is, how can we, as varied as we are in the church, participate in what God is doing in the world with the created order? And how can we help each other participate and practice right relationships with each other and with the world we inhabit? How can we help each other participate? And that's kind of the focus. Some concrete things that we've done in the Green Academy, I just want to share a little bit of the background, is that we have done some urban gardens together, and so we volunteered at this place called Kezar, where they revamped this area that used to be this kind of rundown place, and they made a garden there, and so we've taken some students there. But I want to tell the story of small incorporations, and this is Seth Snoddy. Seth is a basketball player. He just graduated. He is he's just tall, and he found himself in the Green Academy not by his choosing. So he was like put in there, and so he's like, I don't know what this is about. Kind of like me, way before. But so his job was to go, and we had him at our festival. His job for 1 hour was to stand by the compost and recycling and tell students where to put their items, okay? And he came back and he was angry. He was so angry. Not at me. You know who he was angry at? The students. He was angry at the students. And you know, why was he angry at the students?
Because they weren't doing it right.
They didn't do it right. They're not putting it, I tell them, but they don't put it in the right bit. And he just got angry about it. I'm like, this is young African American man, and he's angry about like how they won't listen to him, and he didn't like to feel like the police, you know. I don't feel like the compost police at my church, and I'm telling you, you got to compost that and you got to recycle that. He began to feel that, and he only began to feel that because he was asked to participate. Otherwise, he would not have cared. He would throw, and now he learned. He began to see a little bit more. This ultimately led him to learn more about green issues, and here he is presenting at City Hall, actually. Wow. And he's presenting to different stakeholders about school lunch. So we had a project where we wanted to do a small, doable solution at our school. And so one of it is school lunch. And so I don't know if you know about this, but about 70% of our students are free reduced lunch, which means that they can get lunch from the cafeteria. And but if they get that federally funded food, they have to take 3 out of the 4 choices that are there. So they have to take a vegetable, they have to take a fruit, the dairy, etc. So these students pick this up, and what do you think they do with it once they see that fruit or vegetable?
They throw it away.
And we have so much waste that was not intended by this federal program, but there's this immense waste that's going straight to the trash can. On the other hand, you have students who come after lunch or during the morning, and they're hungry. And they're like, I'm hungry. I had breakfast, right? And so you have these two issues, and we're like, how can we work together to think about this? And so we decided to create a share table. I don't know if you guys are familiar with share tables at schools, but schools sometimes have these share tables where if the student, they have, by federal law, they have to take these items. So once they take the items, they can now put them in the share table, which other students can then pick up the food if they want to, or we have what's left over redistributed to the counseling office where the students go when they're hungry. So you're dealing with hunger as well as with just this waste. And the small incorporations moving into that. Now again, we're not dealing with systemic issues of consumerism and all that. That still is at play, and we want to move in that direction, but we're not going to get there like that, right? And we're not going to become a great poet like that. You know, it needs to start somewhere, and it starts with just paying attention. Okay? So, I would like to move into a poem that I think will help us just be together and to see the value of poetry in this way. And so, this is the first poem I teach to my students. Alright? So, if you're intimidated by poetry, here we go. We're going to start with this poem. It's a poem that's labeled Teaching. What is it? Yeah, yes. Oh, on reading poems to a senior class at South High. Okay? Alright. So, this is not Lectio Divina, but I think there are things that we can use from Lectio, like what are you struck by, what are you stopped by. We're not necessarily going to analyze it and deconstruct it and pick it apart, but what just strikes you about the poem. And then what we'll do is we will get into pairs and talk about what struck us. And then hopefully we can share out and talk together about the poem. Okay? So I'm going to need a male reader voice and a female reader voice for this poem. Can I get some more respect to you? And then can I get a female voice? So we're reading on reading poems to a senior class assignment.
Or just read in a particular order?
Oh, just this particular poem. On reading.
I think you read it first and then.
The whole poem.
Before I opened my mouth, I noticed them sitting there, as orderly as frozen fish in a package. Slowly, water began to fill the room, though I did not notice it till it reached my ears. And then I heard the sounds of fish in an aquarium, and I knew that though I had tried to drown them with my words, that they had only opened up like gills for them and let me in. Together, we swam around the room like 30 tails whacking words till the bell rang, puncturing a hole in the door, where we all leaked out. They went to another class, I suppose, and I went home, where Queen Elizabeth, my cat, met me and licked my fins till they were hands again.
Before I opened my mouth, I noticed them sitting there as orderly as frozen fish in a package. Slowly, water began to fill the room, though I did not notice it until it reached my ears. And then I heard the sounds of fish in an aquarium, and I knew that though I had tried to drown them with my that they had only opened up like gills for them and let me in. Together, we swam around the room like 30 tails whacking words till the bell rang, puncturing a hole in the door where we all leaked out. They went to another class, I suppose, and I home, where Queen Elizabeth, my cat, met me and licked my fins till they were hands again.
Take some time to reread the poem, what stopped you, what struck you, what stood out to you, what question, what made you curious.
Transformation between the...
Sorry, not yet. Okay. Yeah. We'll just have quiet... Question time, and then we'll share with a partner. I'll tell you when. to a partner beside you and can share what struck you about the poem.
Yeah, that's how I'm going to do it.
You can either share for your partner or share for yourself, either way. What were some things that were eye-opening for you or struck you about the poem?
Well, I just noticed this, she made this last time, that, I mean, first you start with this fish, and then you have an aquarium, and then there's, like, back out into nature. Like, it's a progressively more natural or real or old, or I don't know, like,
so you're noticing a progression between there's dead fish
then the aquarium, so they're alive but they're contained in like not really natural, and then like they all get out, they're escaped
into the world.
Yeah.
We kind of talked about how there's just this like moment of surprise in the middle. Where like for us the reader it's like but like it illustrates that I think this moment happened where it surprised everyone in the room too. And then like you went home and you know how to process it. what do you do with it?
And so there's this weird transformation that happens in the middle, from being students and teachers to fish, and then he goes home. How do you deal with that?
Yeah. And my favorite turn phrase, my favorite image is actually there as he's processing it at the end. My cat met me and licked my fins until they were hands again.
What do you,
just the idea that, I mean,
this thing that had happened, A, was so captivating that now he was a fish, and he was a fish until, I guess, something more normal, something regular happened to bring him back to who he was. But also just an image of, of a cat meeting a fish and licking its fins until they were hands again. I don't know, it's just as if that's the cure for your hands being fit.
To get a cat named Queen Elizabeth to lick them and you're back to normal.
That stanza that kind of describes stanza, and I heard the sounds of fish affirm. I think probably a lot of people noticed this, and I knew that though I had tried to drown them with my worries, they only would have killed for them and let me in. It's a moment of confession that I think we've all been there. I tried to do that, I had these wrong motives. But what struck me about it, because I do that all the time, right? I'll look back on my day or look back on something I did, even if it turns out well, like this did, that I'll sort of question my motives. I had this agenda. I was trying to manipulate this person, or I was trying to cram my ideas or wedge my ideas down, this person's throat, or whatever he's kind of confessing here. I had tried to drown them with my words. But it's a moment of confession, but he moves past it very quickly into what the good was that came out of it. For me, that's what I have trouble doing. I can have a moment of confession. I can acknowledge God's grace in bringing something good out of something that maybe I shouldn't have done. Mm-hmm. But then instead of fixating on the grace, I fixate on what I did wrong, and that shapes the rest of my day. That didn't happen for I'm saying him, I don't know, maybe it's, for the poet. The poet fixates after that one phrase. I tried to drown them with my words. But here's what happened. This grace, this good, beautiful thing that happened.
So he sees what perhaps he's done wrong, but then he's able to move forward with that.
The good that came out of it, even what he did wrong.
And you call that moment of grace?
Yeah, I see it as grace. I like your point, filling the air. Well, building on both of those, Ben had a great point that connected some of what Aaron and Mitch said. I thought that we start with this interesting image of the frozen fish and our natural sort of response to frozen fish. We're the predators of frozen fish, humans are, right? If I see a box of fish sticks, that's there for one purpose. It's there for me as a human to eat it. And then he confronts, when he's a fish, he confronts a predator, a cat.
So going back to that licking.
Yeah, so
that's a weird image.
So those two images are almost predators confronting the fish, but yet still something good comes out of it. Out of those encounters.
And him encountering the classroom almost in a sort of similar domineering sort of way.
Right.
Uh-huh.
Those two images bookend the transformation. I thought that was a great insight.
Any other thoughts or reflections?
I just wanted to think kind of on top of that, just how the roles are, and tie into the themes of creation as well.
Sure, absolutely.
In terms of how it's not one or the other, in terms of one person is the instigator, the other just receives, but it's wonderfully ambiguous. With regards to, he does something, some of it's not great intentions, but he does play a part in the water film. But then I like the image of him becoming one of the fish, even though he didn't see that. And both receptive and with the cat playing a transformative role in his life, as well as him playing a transformative role with the students, but the students also playing a transformative role in him. It's just wonderfully, I think, ambiguous how they all are interacting, I guess is the word, in each other's both world changing and I think invigorating and life giving experience.
Yeah, and I think that's, the word I would use is like participating, that everyone is like participating in this activity, some with mixed motives that get reshaped and they get brought into this larger thing that's happening. But this interactive thing that happens.
So something just struck me that I didn't catch at first, but you know, we're talking about a class in a school and then turn into a school of fish. So I like that. I like that. But also the contrast between how there are these orderly frozen fish, you know, very, everything seems ordered and dead and quiet, and then it transforms into chaotic life, almost like in that paragraph, 30 tails whacking words. It's almost like a game that they're just batting back and forth.
Yeah.
Really beautiful contrast to the frozen order.
And, I mean, that reminds me also very, I think, your point about Ben's point about the predatory nature, or it's there for my consumption. It's very institutionalized, very orderly. I mean, I'm part of the educational system, and the system is in such a way that it's very, there are rows, there are, you know, students have their numbers that we track them by, and what is preventing us from moving beyond that orderliness or that institution that's happening there. I want to move us forward because we're running out of time, but I'm going to skip this slide, and I'm drowning you with words. Sorry. I found Deborah Dean Murphy writes this book called Teaching That Transforms, which is apropos, I think, with this teacher becoming a fish. But I think it gets to the point that Ben and Mitchell makes about this kind of symbiotic, or you know, this new relationship that is happening between people. And what she writes about is, how do you confront these powers? Instead of just being overwhelmed by the powers, or being complicit, or being in denial of these powers, where is our engagement? Where is our participation? How can we get to this point where things are we're whacking words together, that we're interacting with our cat in a different way, that the predator and the prey can live together, the lion and the lamb, you know, all this stuff, how can that happen? We have the conflicts and disagreements that arise when Christians begin to confront their consumeristic, narcissistic patterns and habits need to be located in the practice of peaceable unity, a unity that the Eucharist itself is. Difference need not be destructive when we remember that we sing together, confess our sin together, in many ways this confessional moment that this teacher has, and commune at Christ's table together, that our common life is rooted not in shared interests or general like-mindedness. It's not just about, okay, we have this particular agenda, we have the environmental agenda, and let's just go with it. That is a very small picture of God's, what maybe God is doing. But in the unity of Christ, made possible by the work of the Holy Spirit, a unity that allows us to speak the truth in love about ourselves to one another. The discernment that becomes possible when we risk opening ourselves up to such corporate scrutiny and accountability is seen with new eyes that shapes our work and witness in the world. So the question of how can we enter in, how can we incorporate or participate and change the dynamics that we live by. There is an urgency to this. There is practical things that we need to do. Seth Snoddy needs to learn about composting. He needs to learn these things. And yet, where is the answer? And I feel like God loves the world and the way his expression is through the church. And how do we live that out and be prophetic in that way? I want to end, we only have about 20 minutes, and I want to spend the last time reading this poem by Seamus Heaney. It's called St. Kevin and the Blackbird, and 20 minutes does not do it justice. I know, again, some of you are feeling the creep and lull of post-prandial sleep coming upon you. I ask you to fight it, as I ask my students to fight it. But we have 20 minutes, I want us to read it, and we won't turn to our partners, but we'll spend some time reflecting on it and what strikes you. And keeping in mind what we've already talked about, but also what we've heard throughout this week so far. It has been a week. It's only been a day. It feels like a week worth of stuff, you know, in my head right now. So, why don't we have two readers again.
And then there was St. Kevin and the Blackbird. The saint is kneeling, arms stretched out, inside the cell. But the cell is narrow, so one turned up palm is out the window. stiff as a crossbeam. When the blackbird lands and lays in it, it settles down the nest. Kevin feels the warm eggs, the small breasts, the tucked meat head and claws, and finding himself linked into the network of eternal life, is moved to pity. Now he must hold his hand like a branch out in the sun and rain for weeks until the young are hatched and fledged and flown. And since the whole thing's imagined anyhow, imagine being Kevin, which is he, self-forgetful or in agony all the time, from the neck on, out down through his hurting forearms. Are his fingers sleeping? Does he still feel his knees? Or has the shut-eyed blank of underneath crept up through him? Is there distance in his head, alone and mirrored, clear love's deep river, to labor and not to seek reward he prays? A prayer his body makes entirely for his forgotten self, forgotten bird, and on the riverbank, forgotten in the river's name.
And then there was St. Kevin and the Blackbird. The saint is kneeling, arms stretched out inside his cell. The cell is narrow, so one turned up palm is out the window. Stiff as a crossbeam, when a blackbird lays in it and settles down to nest. Kevin feels the warm eggs, the small breast, the tattooed head and claws, and finding himself linked into the network of eternal life, is moved to pity. Now he must hold his hand like a branch out in the sun and rain for weeks, until the young are hatched and fledged and flame. And since the whole thing's imagined anyhow, imagine being Kevin. Which is he? Self-forgetful or in agony all the time, from the neck on out, down through his hurrying forearms? Are his fingers sleeping? Does he still feel his knees? Or has the shut-eyed blank of under-earth crept up through him? Is there distance in his head? Alone and mirrored clear in love's deep river, to labor and not to seek reward, praise. A prayer his body makes entirely, for he has forgotten self, forgotten bird, and on the riverbank, forgot the river's name.
Take just a little bit of time to look back at the poem and think back at our time together here as well as the last 2 days. Let's see what it means for you. So in the interest of time, I won't break us up into pairs, but we'd love to hear any impressions or things that came up for you as you start putting things together from the last 2 days and how this poem perhaps helps you see a little bit clearer. Or maybe it makes a question. Maybe it brings up stuff for you.
connection with those things.
I have the image of Saint Kevin realizing that he had, whether he liked it or not, become a tree. There was a nest, a bird's nest, or a bird, you know, laying in his palm. And so he's faced with this decision to continue being that. Well, the poem presents it as if he doesn't even have a choice. Mm-hmm. Now he's just, he has this responsibility to, you know, have his arm outstretched until those birds are hatched and fledged and flown. And so trying to imagine what it would be like to have that patience or to have that longevity of holding that same position like a tree, it just made me think back to Lectio this morning. And one thing that I know was a very present theme at the table that I was at, but I think it was also mentioned around the room, was the different perspectives of the different animals and how they each have something to teach us. So just the connection there, that here's another aspect of creation that we can learn from, or that can shed a new perspective on the network of eternal life.
Connect with a pitch that, I mean, within the Christian tradition, tree has this double meaning, and you know, he becomes a tree, kind of housing this bird, and this bird's nest. But the two metaphors or the images that similes that are used to describe his poem is like a branch and like a crossbeam. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's the sort of the two images we have of tree in the Christian tradition: one being something of life, a tree kind of producing fruit. But then the cross is also called a tree, so it's this place. And I couldn't help, when hearing about his outstretched palm, I couldn't help but think of Norman's talk yesterday about this is how we should approach nature, not grasping. But so I thought of this, to hold his hand out like this, but like a cross beam, there's another juxtaposition, a posture of receptivity, but also a posture of sacrifice, and a posture of prayer and martyrdom. And I mean, there's just, I feel like what Haney's doing is he's bringing all of these sort of juxtapositions together to create this image. This is what a saint's life maybe is like. Mm-hmm. It's both prayer and martyrdom, or prayer, you know, sacrifice and receptivity, death and life. Mm-hmm. All through this simple image doing this. It's an amazing thing.
I think because of the intent in our midst, it made me think of holding children that are sleeping, and where you're sitting, you know, either standing or sitting on a couch, you basically have the whole, especially ones that will wake up, you know, and that there is that sensation of, okay, do I feel my arm anymore? And the needing to keep very still, and I think some of the things that we've been talking about this weekend in terms of what is the relationship of human beings to the rest of creation, and this whole idea of serving. Or protecting something to do as a service to creation. I felt like that's kind of reflected in this poem that St. Kevin is serving this blackbird, and his service is a sacrificial service. So it's interesting to think of, well, how will we relate in the same way that we relate to the infant that we need to keep perfectly still in order.
In the last lecture I thought I was in, it was about natural burial, and one of the images he showed was how early church, there is this mosaic from an early century that was a cross also posed on the tree of life. So it was like very much those two trees on the very same thing, and it was in a place that St. Francis would have seen, like it would have existed for about 40 years when St. Francis came through. And so I don't know, like in talking about this St. Kevin being both tree and tree. Like, I mean, I wish it was nice. I hadn't realized how much you can learn from two things.
I think it's sort of like, along some of these lines, that can read it vocationally in the sense that there's something that he said that wasn't like he started the day off thinking this is what I'm going to do,
right.
You know. But
I'm going to hold the bird in my hand.
And I think that's in some ways our vocations are like that, where the things that come into our lives and we find our vocation in and through some of these circumstances that are offered to us, I think. Maybe not always, but I think a lot of times. Mm-hmm. And then with regards to, we were talking at lunch, just the different versions of how the world's going to end, you know, chart, you know? And it can be...
Yeah, it was like,
It can be pretty overwhelming, and, but... You know, the mention of the work of the Holy Spirit that makes all things possible, and the thing that part of how we participate in the redemption of the world is being receptive and being a good steward to what Kevin wasn't concerned with, the nests of all planets, you know, and what system do we need to put together that will bring about the safety of the nesting habits of all life. That can be overwhelming, sure. You know.
Yeah.
And this is hard enough, but just that image of, with regards to creation and the receptivity, what's in our immediate grasp, and be attentive to that, be attentive to that aspect of the environment that is
right there.
Literally touch, you know.
Right.
Yeah.
He didn't think he was going to start a day doing this. He didn't think he was going to start a day by praying. And that's an obligation to start.
Right. Yeah.
Because when we pray, we make ourselves open to whatever vocation may come our way. So, yeah, that's a good point.
I got hung up on the what has the shut eyes blank of underneath kept up through him. Like, what is that? Because on the surface, yeah. It's like, that looks like death. Mm-hmm. But what he's doing is not death, it's life. I mean, this is. It's because his self is dissolving, but it is not. He is not dead. This is not bad, but he is very much not present in the way he was at the beginning. And so, trying to think about what's happening here, and what's happening as we talk about all this big stuff that could easily feel squashed by.
Exactly. That the end is near. This death. These graphs and I mean, does death have the last word? Is do we believe that? I don't think so.
Is the shut eye? I mean, because I have the same question as you about what is the shut eye blank of under?
I don't think it's the. I don't know.
If we take Mitch's idea that he'd become a tree, mm-hmm. I mean, if under earth is soil, that's how a tree lives because the nutrients in the soil creep up into the tree. By rooting himself down into this place, the under earth creeps up through him, and that's what provides, you know, the life that is, housing the bird or the branch.
I'm sorry, I should clarify my statement. I didn't think that he thought he actually became a tree or anything, but it seemed apparent from the situation that he is now filling the niche of a tree.
No, right. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
No, I know he's not thinking of it. But you're right. He's and so the shut eye blank of under earth would symbolize something about the place where he's kneeling, giving him the capacity to then, you know, be that niche or fulfill that niche or be that tree or be the place where the blackbird rests. Which goes with what Chad was saying earlier, you know, connecting to a place.
Yeah.
And what Barry would say, of course, you know, from that place, we receive the strength to fulfill our vocation.
Right.
So that's, I think that's what's going on.
And what God has given you in this particular place, and you can only know what God has given you in that particular place if you're there. You're somewhere.
Your hands are open.
Your hands are open, not grasping.
Yeah. You know, you could also imagine this as, the first thing when I saw the tower, I just thought of the garden statue. And I just had this thought that, you don't really get any sense that Kevin is necessarily alive until you get to the point where you can do this for more things. So maybe if we're even looking at this from an anthropomorphic viewpoint, well, maybe Kevin is actually a statue, and he's coming to life through interacting with this bird.
That's cool.
You're going back into the frozen fish, the Venus poem, and that transformation that happens for them to become alive, but also the human becoming a fish, or the statue coming to life through the connection they make.
The quote, to labor and not to seek the Lord, is that from something that we know? Is that from Book of Common Prayer, or is that?
I think it is a quote from Saint. Yes.
Man, I'm assuming one of the
saints. There you go.
I'm assuming there's something, some connection that we should, I should be able to make. That I mean,
you should be nice. Oh, I say you make you think. Oh, wow. She's like,
Kelly Paul.
Thank you.
Wow.
I look outside your showers.
We're close to ending. I do want to end on this note, and I think it is heavy what Chad was bringing to us in that session, and I just want to end with the one of the phrases that stood out to me, like after many readings of it, is after the star, and since the whole thing's imagined anyhow, it's like this actually never happened, or you know, if this is a myth that Saint Kevin did this, and it's kind of like the question I'm like. Kids that ask me, why are you doing poetry? This is all made up stuff. It's all fiction. It's not real. But somehow, this imagination enlivens us to reality, that it becomes real through the imagination. And I just want to end with this idea of transformative imagination. And this is, again, two quotes from Fred Thompson in the book Making Peace with the Land. And I would not hope that we would not end defeated and feeling like we have to do something or the world's going to come to an end, but that poetry points to the kind of imagination we will need if we're to mitigate the damage we've inflicted on the soil and thus on ourselves. This slowing down, this paying attention, this being placed in place, all those things are very important to mitigating this damage. And his prayer, and I think my prayer as well, is for the church. That our church is that we will stretch our Eucharistic imaginations and see that the sacrament of Christ's body and blood doesn't end at the altar. That St. Kevin's not just not kneeling for himself for penance or for, like, this is what you do because you're a saint or a martyr. But that God's communion spreads outward into the fields, the creeks and rivers, the gardens and farms that feed us out to the stranger on the road and back again to the lifted elements. Had we the conviction, of St. Ignatius, conviction of things not seen, we would recognize the seamless flow of nutrients, both visible and invisible, profane and holy, and we would be changed. And so I hope my prayer is that we would find this transformative, that we would not be hopeless, but that we would seek our hope in Christ, who and as God has the whole world in his hands. Well, thank you. I think we're done with our time, and I appreciate you being here. You may keep some of the objects if you want to as a memento. but thank you, and I hope that we continue to talk to each other.